Hello and welcome to The Roadmap, a podcast recorded by Bristers in London. We're here to help you map out and navigate tech law topics and transactions. My name's Annika Pohl and I'm an associate in the Bristers Commercial Technology team. I'm very fortunate today to be joined by Emily Atkinson, an associate in our employment team. Hi Emily, welcome to The Roadmap.
Hi Annika.
And Vic Karana, a partner in our Commercial Technology team. Welcome Vic, thanks for joining us on this chilly winter day.
Thanks, Annika.
Today, we're going to focus on the importance of people in delivering a successful digital transformation project to your company. Often, a digital transformation is not only about the underlying technology, but also the people within and outside the organization who work together to deliver something new. Many of our listeners will have witnessed firsthand in their organizations how crucial people are to the success of a digital transformation project. In particular, in the tech team here at Bristers, we often see the importance of people to a successful organization when we work on complex digital transformation projects. Adopting a collaborative approach with the right people at its core will often be a crucial factor in the success of these projects. In this podcast episode, we will explore in-house and outsourced digital transformation projects through an employment lens. Emily will walk us through three of the key considerations for an in-house digital transformation project, and then Vic and Emily will chat about some of the practical ways that you could bake employment considerations into an outsourced digital transformation deal. Emily, often we see at Bristers that our clients may want to do aspects or all of a digital transformation project in-house. What are a couple of ways they could go about this?
So one option is a type of corporate acquisition often referred to as an acqui-hire. I know in your previous podcast with Lou, Drishy and Vic, you talked about corporate acquisitions more generally, but acqui-hires are a relatively new concept. So they started in the US with big tech companies such as Facebook and Google, who would acquire like generally commercially unviable businesses, not for their products, their ideas or their assets, but for the technical abilities of their employees. So this is an increasingly common type of acquisition that we've seen a number of UK companies attempting. And you can see why this might seem like an attractive option given the shortage of talent in the tech sector. But the risk in taking this approach is that the employees won't stick around for long enough to complete the digital transformation project. This is because acquires often involve larger corporate businesses acquiring tech startups, which inevitably means a big change in culture for the startup's founders and engineers. So it's important that the integration of these employees is managed carefully to ensure that they stick around for the long term. And financial retention incentives may help, but the key that we found is giving these employees flexibility and the opportunity to continue being creative.
Okay, so one option is acquiring a company to get talent. What are some of the other options out there, Emily?
So another option we are seeing employers consider is hiring staff based overseas using a professional employer organization or PEO. Given the time and money involved in setting up an overseas subsidiary, this may seem like an easy choice, but employers do need to be aware that ultimately the employment liabilities will remain with them and PEOs tend to charge substantial fees. There's also always associated tax risks. Clients opting to use PEOs need to consider that if the employees will be creating valuable code as part of a digital transformation project, then they will need to check the IP provisions carefully in the agreement with the PEO and also any statutory rules that apply in the relevant jurisdiction so that they can be sure that any IP created by the employee belongs to them.
So we've discussed two different options if a business doesn't have the technical talent already, but what about keeping valuable talent?
So I think that's a really important point. And as I've mentioned, and I'm sure most people will be aware, there is a labour shortage in almost all sectors of the UK economy, but the war for talent in the tech industry is particularly fierce, in part due to the widespread move towards automation and cloud computing. For example, we've seen statistics from Tech Nation that show that between 2017 and 2018, employer demand for cloud skills only grew by 3.4% compared to growth of 22% between 2018 to 2019. Other data from TechNation shows that between June to August of 2020, during the COVID pandemic, there was a 36% increase in advertised vacancies in digital tech. So these stats show the continued importance of retaining existing employees, particularly those such as software developers or data scientists, with the key skills needed to deliver the digital transformation project in-house. To do this, I think compensation is an obvious consideration, and packages obviously need to be competitive. But in the tech industry, other benefits such as share incentive schemes, flexible working options, things like that can be equally important, as well as maintaining a positive company culture.
Our clients will often outsource at least components of their digital transformation deals. Vic, during a digital transformation process, how do we assist our clients to build people in during the process?
That's a good question. Thanks, Annika. And so Emily's talked there about how to manage and talented people in-house. But as you say, when you're doing an outsourcing or working externally with vendors to deliver transformation, it's going to be really important to have a focus on your service providers' people, especially if the reason for going external is to sort of tap into that industry expertise. So, you know, we're seeing that at each stage of a sourcing project, that there are ways to make sure there's at least some focus on that outsourced talent. So whether that's from the RFP stage at the start, into transition, and then into the kind of delivery stage, and then finally at exit. So right at the outset then, if you're running an RFP process to hire a vendor, thinking about the people side, like there's a few things to think about, things you can do. So first of all, why not try and assess their people's kind of capability? Most of the transformation deals we work on, they're often kind of strategic partnerships, giving you access to, you know, the vendor's people and skills. So why not reflect that in the questions you ask your potential vendors during the bid stage? You know, ask for their experience in delivering similar projects or for clients in the same sector, and then ask who the people are that actually delivered them. And maybe you could even try and meet them during the process and see if they'd be available to work on your account if you choose them. And that can build confidence among the team that you're actually getting the A-team from the vendor side. And also, if your teams have met the people who will actually be delivering for you, they can actually start creating a positive relationship even before the contract is signed. Another thing to think about at the outset is the sort of resourcing model. So from a people perspective, most transformational projects need to fuse that external experience with, you know, your own people to perform that kind of real partnership. And you might reflect that in the RFP by asking vendors to show how their people actually go about engaging and collaborating. So say on an agile development project, like, will they be working with you to form a mixed project team? You know, will they work with you side by side at your own premises? That those kind of questions can help tease out whether your potential partner is going to have a purely contractual kind of customer supplier mindset, or if they're going to be willing to be a genuine business partner. And the final thing at the RFP stage is to think about asking about the vendor's kind of internal policies. Like, most large tech companies will operate internal reward schemes so that they kind of promote a positive culture and retain their best people. You know, why not ask what your kind of vendor's reward schemes look like? You can kind of assess whether they're aligned with what success looks like for you. So for example, if those reward schemes reward their people for like customer satisfaction, that's the kind of metric you can use to show that, you know, this organization in this process is taking people more seriously and help you build confidence at the outset.
Yeah, I think they're all really important points to consider in the vendor selection process. But another thing to think about is the employees who will be keeping the business running during this process, as we often see a long lead-in time to digital transformation projects. Particularly on a first-generation outsourcing where 2P is unlikely to apply, as a result of the UK's redundancy framework, employees will often need to be told that they may be made redundant long before their employment will actually be terminated. So I think employers going down this route need to think about how they can incentivize employees to remain productive and continue performing their roles effectively when they know that their roles ultimately are going to be made redundant. In our experience, employee communications and messaging are key to keeping employees on side. And that can save even the most difficult process for employers.
So Vic, thinking about the contract, what are some of the key terms you would include to address some of these people-related issues that you and Emily have both raised?
Yeah, a couple of types of kind of clauses you end up including that we see kind of the customer side sort of leaning on quite a bit sometimes. So first of all, it's about key personnel. You know, it can be pretty standard to say that there's going to be a set of people on the vendor side who need to stay sort of locked into the accounts. So you've got that kind of focus. But quite often, the focus is on having like an account manager or a transition manager. But maybe have a think about, you know, people who are delivering that kind of innovation that you chose the vendor for in the first place. Do you know who they are? And can you say, look, they've got to be working on my account, and naming them as key personnel in the contract. Another area is around kind of dealing with that kind of high turnover. Emily talked about that kind of war for talent in the tech industry. And what that means when you appoint a supplier is that turnover rates on their side can be especially high at the moment, especially in offshore jurisdictions like in India. And that can be a problem because digital transformation often requires the people you partner with to actually get to know your business at quite a detailed level to sort of help you innovate, understand your objectives, especially when you've got like agile or mixed teams working closely together. They need to be building those working relationships. So what we're seeing to try and protect against that is customers kind of building in, you know, service levels or KPIs that measure the actual retention rates among the supplier personnel on their account. And if those are not met, maybe even backed up by service credits or even termination or other remedies that might help mitigate that risk that the people working on your account among your vendor keep changing and you're not getting that strategic input or innovation that you appointed that vendor for in the first place. The only watchword I'd raise here is you've got to be realistic about what those retention benchmarks are. And there are some industry and territory specific benchmarks out there. For example, you know, the rate of retention among, you know, software engineers in India, for example, that you can refer to in those SLAs.
Thanks, Vic. In the UK, something to always think about are 2P considerations, and we shouldn't forget them. Emily, could you tell us a bit more about how 2P works?
Of course. So from my perspective as an employment lawyer, 2P, the rules that govern employee transfers in the UK, should always be at the forefront of a client's mind at the outset of a digital transformation project involving outsourcing. In the UK, the position under 2P is generally that if services are transferred in-house or to a replacement provider, then the employees performing those services will automatically transfer too. When it comes to tech outsourcing, in our experience, the client or new incoming provider will often want the technical employees, such as software developers or data scientists, to transfer to them, given the shortage of talent in the sector. So including appropriate contractual provisions in the HR schedule of the service agreement at the outset is crucial to ensuring that employees with the technical knowledge required to deliver the project transfer to any incoming provider. Final 2P point from me is for clients to remember that as digital transformation does often involve outsourcing from the UK to overseas, it's important to realise this will not in itself prevent 2P applying. And although 2P won't impact the transfer of services from one overseas territory to another, there may be other local employee transfer rules to think about.
Thanks. That's super insightful overview of 2P, particularly that we need to think about it early on in the process. We've discussed the early stages of a deal and the RFP process, but what about the ongoing provision of services? Vic, I know this is something always on our mind when we're building out a contract. Could you tell us a bit about how we think about people in the ongoing provision of services?
Yeah, sure. So I think we're getting the sense as we discuss this that it is kind of the people who are often driving these deals, obviously. And that includes kind of the innovation improvement side, but also sort of the charging side. So I'll just sort of touch on those two elements pretty briefly. So on that kind of innovation side, we see a lot of contracts where you've got these high level principles or objectives saying, you know, the parties who are intending this deal to innovate something or to improve some internal process or something like that. But often those are quite kind of woolly and quite loose. So we're looking at ways that you can make that more practical. So, for example, in a governance process, can you make it an individual's job at the supplier side to come prepared, you know, each quarter or whatever the regularity is, with kind of concrete ideas and proposals for delivering that kind of service improvement, which can then be sort of implemented? I think one thing we sometimes forget is the suppliers, people, you know, like being creative and they like solving problems, but often in a way that is kind of de-risked for them. So especially if there's some sort of win-win. So say there was some sort of jointly funded innovation fund which could fund that innovation, and you appoint someone at your supplier who can be responsible for that. It's a more practical way. You know, these are backed up by contractual obligations, but they're more practical governance-driven ways to get that kind of improvement. And I'll just touch upon kind of pricing and I guess the cost of people, which are driving a lot of commercial terms and deals, especially at the moment. So many longer term contracts that we deal with will have those kinds of price increase mechanics linked to the rising cost of people, indexation and what have you. Especially at the moment when there's a big inflationary effect on wages in the industry. And what we're finding is in that scenario, the customer can be quite at risk from some pretty hefty annual price hikes. So what we're looking at working with customers to do is maybe not accept those automatic price hikes automatically, but try and incentivize the vendor to try and offset the cost of people in other ways. So you could, for example, incentivize them by having, you know, caps around what they can charge you as increases every year, but making sure that they've got ways to then offset that by maybe using their people more efficiently as they get to know you and get more experience in providing the service, and also encourage them to introduce technology improvements like software and automation that can start to kind of lower the amount of direct kind of processing responsibility done by people, relying more on scalable tech with the kind of cost benefits that sort of has.
Thanks, Vic. What about when we're thinking about exiting a transaction? Are there some things that we can bake in at the start of the process or during a process to make exiting more seamless?
Yeah, sure. I think a lot of people will be familiar with reaching the end of a life cycle of a project or a deal and finding that it's very hard to then transition away from that service or that vendor, because that sort of thinking up front about planning for exit hasn't been done. There might be some high level exit provisions or a schedule to the agreement, but nothing further has been done on that. And what we're finding, and it sort of happens in some of the M&A context as well, actually, when preparing a business for sale, is understanding actually what the people at a very low level are doing process-wise and what their jobs and their roles and responsibilities are is one way to try and map out the knowledge that's needed to transfer the service either in-house or to a new vendor. So I think it's about trying to set up a plan where it becomes someone, ideally the vendor's responsibility, to map out at that detail level what all their people are doing, where they're based, even what their job titles are, because that can inform sort of what they're doing. And then making sure that's documented in a way so that when exit is finally sort of triggered, the customer's kind of got an understanding of what it would need to replicate internally as a model of its people to deliver the resources. Or also if it's going out to the market again, that it can communicate clearly to a new set of bidders the kinds of FTEs and personnel that it would need to run something similar. Now, they may not want to do it the same way, but having that view on how it's been done today is really important. And I think that's something that often gets missed, even in the best laid kind of exit plan. It often won't go into that kind of people level granularity.
Yeah, I completely agree. We see this often, particularly on large outsourcing transactions and digital transformation projects, that it may be left towards the end of the process to start to consider the exit. But it's really important to have those conversations upfront and early on while there's still a lot of goodwill. So some of the takeaways from today are that people drive the success of these deals. So it's really important to have the key people involved in delivering a digital transformation project from the outset. Remember to think about the impact of 2P at the beginning of the outsourcing process rather than at the last minute. Carry out due diligence on your potential suppliers so you can build in contractual mechanisms to proactively address personnel issues during the life cycle of a transaction. And remember to keep an eye out for knowledge transfer within a business so you confuse external experience with your own people to form a true partnership that has a collective goal. Thanks, Emily and Vic, for joining us today on The Roadmap.
Thanks, Annika.
Thanks, Annika.
Subscribe, download, and share this podcast. We want to make The Roadmap as practical and informative as possible for you and your business. If you have any ideas, suggestions, or feedback on this or future episodes, shoot us an email at theroadmap@bristows.com or use the hashtag TheRoadmapPod. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with the next episode soon.